be about globalization, inequality, etc., dominance of the West, and what kind of thing. And you know, everyone, I think, in the LSC should follow what's going on in these debates, because it's a real amazing encounter. But it's not an encounter between, as it were, the agencies of globalization and those who resist it. It's an encounter between two aspects, two forms, two versions of globalization. I think that you know, the debate will tend to shift after what happened in Seattle. It'll be very interesting to trace its further evolution. Anyway, I plan to talk about these issues in a pretty direct way next term, next year, next century, next millennium, in about mid-January. But this time I'm going to talk more about the impact of globalization on personal life. I mean, these things are not so disconnected as you would imagine. About 10 days ago, I was lucky enough to go to this Florence summit of world leaders, where there was Clinton, Blair, Jospin, Schroeder, other people. You're sort of sitting with these people, and you know, you don't really tend to think about politics as such. You sort of wonder about their personal life, because there you have Bill Clinton involved in this famous episode. Well, which, you know, could have obviously shifted the structure of world politics, because he was only a little while away, really, from losing the presidency. And you couldn't get a more extraordinary connection between sexuality and politics, really, I think, than what happened in that episode. And then alongside him, there was Tony Blair and there was Sheree Booth. Well, Sheree Booth, as you probably know, if you don't, you should know, I think I mentioned it last time, as a graduate of the LSE, but also an expectant mother, as you might have read about. And there you have the Blair family, you know, have this apparently really happy family in Italy. Well, the Blairs now have four children. You know, that's revolutionary in Europe, have four children. Well, this conference was in Italy. You know what the birth rate is in Italy. It's about 1.1, which is possibly, along with Spain, the lowest birth rate ever known in human history, actually. Well short of the society reproducing itself. So, you know, you tend to think of Italy, Catholic country, country with lots of children, but actually the reverse is true. All over Europe, with some exceptions, you have a massive drop in the birth rate. Obviously symptomatic of restructuring of the family. And then I got on a plane to come home from the sort of jaunt, and I opened the newspapers, and there is a Jeffrey Archer, about which not much needs to be said, but there again there's a rather obvious interconnection between sexuality and politics, and something obviously about male sexuality in it all. Something about the family, images of the family, what supports the image of the family and what destroys the image of the family. All sorts of interesting images and messages, really, I think, in all that. And then, having read about Jeffrey Archer, opened the newspaper, and inside the newspaper there was an account of a transsexual, a man who changed into a woman, wishing to acquire full rights of parentage in Europe. And then further down on the same page, there was a discussion of homosexual marriage. And according to the article, about four countries now either have or are legitimizing homosexual marriage, so that gays can get married in the same way as heterosexuals can get married. Put all that together, so, you know, it's a remarkable for everyday kind of expression of the changes affecting the family. And therefore we're trying to work out what all this adds up to, where the family is going, how it interlaces with changes in sexuality, our relationship to our emotions, and changing relationship between the sexes. You know, it's a fundamental aspect of the globalization debate. And it's not at all accidental that everywhere in the world there is a debate about the future of the family, and that debate, the only places where it doesn't exist, I feel, is where it's actively repressed, you know, by authoritarian authoritarian regimes or fundamentalist regimes, almost everywhere there is an active debate about what the future shape of a family should be. And I'd suggest to you there are two sort of opposed versions of it, just that there are two opposed versions of globalization, if you like. On the one hand, there are those who are the defenders of the traditional family. I think you have to use the word traditional family in quotation marks, certainly for the time being, because the term traditional family includes a lot of variation in family types. Those who would defend the traditional family tend to be on the political right, I think. They tend to see the family in a crisis of disintegration. They tend to see, if you consider all the things I just mentioned, there is a state of crisis of the family, especially in Western countries, bound up with the decay of traditional family forms. I think people who take this view would see homosexual marriage as a scandal and see it as specifically, in quotes, unnatural, and would strongly resist any kind of legitimation of gay relationships in law of this sort. And they would resist and condemn, I think, many of the other aspects of the things that we see going on around us. Defenders of the traditional family then have a kind of analysis of what's going on in the world, and it's really an analysis which suggests that there was a time when the traditional family was functioning well. That time has now passed, and the traditional family has been attacked, partly by political trends, partly by socioeconomic trends, in order to kind of put our society back together again, and put our own lives back together again, we need to shore up the traditional family. You know, there are lots of pragmatic implications of that. For example, people on that side of the coin in the debate would say, well, let's make divorce much harder. Let's reintroduce the idea of fault in divorce, because most countries like this one have introduced no-fault divorce. Defenders of traditional family say, well, that legitimizes kind of free and easy behavior, the easy abandonment of spouses. Let's tighten the whole thing up. Let's go back to the traditional family and re-establish it as the core of our society. Although I think on the whole people who hold that view are on the political right, it's certainly not universally so, because if you read the columnist Melanie Phillips in the Sunday Times, she certainly claims to be left of centre person, but she's a strong defender of the traditional family, of the Orthodox family, and the need to return to it in contemporary societies. On the other side, there are those who hold a completely different view, almost the opposite view, really, that what we're seeing is a proliferation of family forms, a diversity of forms of the family, linked to diversification of individual life. And this proliferation, so this argument runs, is healthy and necessary in a modern society. So according to those on the liberal side of the fence, one-parent families, for example, now make up about a third of the total in the UK, about a third of the total in France. Never married women with children make up more than 50% of the total in one or two Scandinavian countries. People who hold this second view say, well, this is to be welcomed, to be applauded, because people are breaking away from the constraints of the traditional family, traditional marriage, traditional sexuality too. So this is a kind of let a thousand flowers bloom type of philosophy, and it is kind of laissez-faire, I suppose, philosophy for the morality of everyday life. It tends to appeal to people on the left, but not universally so. Many people on the libertarian right, on as it were the extreme libertarian right, actively support these trends. development. So it's not wholly a left-right division. It is a kind of division about what you make of the family and what's happened to it in the light of the changes going on in contemporary societies. Well, what is it happening to it? What are the changes affecting the family? The changes, I think, are fairly easy to identify, and they are becoming global. Although, of course, in every country you have diversity of family forms. In the UK, for example, you have plenty of people living in quite traditional family cultures. But on the whole, there are a series of worldwide trends which are tending to affect the family almost everywhere in greater or lesser degrees. In less developed countries, they tend to be more advanced in the cosmopolitan urban centres than they do in the rural areas. Let me just mention a few of the key things. First of all, the traditional family, if you still recognize that is a very wide category. Traditional family everywhere tended to involve fixed roles, especially fixed roles for men and women, built around the institution of marriage. So in the UK, for example, a generation ago, someone who got married, they certainly knew what life by and large held in store for them. Marriage was a structured passage in life. And the main question you would ask someone, really, 30 years or so ago, was, are you married or are you not? If you weren't married, you had a certain status outside of marriage, viz., by a certain age, you were a spinster or you were a bachelor. And both of those terms, including bachelor, tended to have a negative ring to them. Something wrong with you if you weren't already married by a certain age. Not that long ago, this was true. It's fixed roles because there was division of labour in the family. Division of labour tends to be a prototypical traditional family. Doesn't mean that women don't work, of course. They often, in many cultures, work much harder than men, but their work tends very much to centre on the domestic milieu, and the bringing up of children traditionally has been the fate of women in most cultures across the world. In most cultures, if you don't have children, there is something wrong with you. As a woman, women were desperate in traditional cultures to have children if they don't actually produce them. Domesticity, child rearing, they're the kind of threads of a woman's life in the traditional family. Division of labour for men, Western countries anyway, meant that men were the breadwinners, although of course many women went out to work besides working in the home. Nevertheless, by and large, the large majority in the UK, most women gave up work, paid work, when they got married. They might go back into the labour force when their children have grown up. And men, by and large, were expected to supply the income and support the family. That's the idea of a family wage. Family wage was the wage you had to pay a worker to support the family. That worker, normally a male worker. In the Beveridge report, The Origin of the Welfare State, you know, it was based around the idea of the male as the breadwinner, paying the family wage, supporting the family. That was accepted as the institutionalized structure, what the family was. Well, this is the first dimension of change, and we've been talking about it already in these lectures. This is part of what I was calling detraditionalization in the last lecture. These things are no longer true. Women and men in contemporary societies no longer have fixed roles in the way in which they did. Marriage is no longer so clearly institutionalized in the way in which it was. It's a much more active decision whether you decide to get married to someone, even if you're living with them, than it used to be in Western countries. A very high proportion of people live with somebody else before they get married to them. A generation ago, this was almost impossible for the majority because the social opprobrium against it was so strong. If you set up a household with another person today, you do it in a kind of much more open information milieu. Because in some sense or another, you're kind of involved in the wider social debate about marriage. It's not just an academic debate or a political one, it's an existential one, because You have to decide, what does marriage mean for me? I know that so many people get divorced. Does it have the same sense it used to? Well, it doesn't really. Situation where women are different position from the past, where of course you can set up a household with someone of the same sex, not just of a different sex, and that can also be a sexual relationship. You have a wide range of same sex sexual relationships in contemporary societies. So these are very, very big structural changes, really, the nature of the traditional family. Second, traditional family was always primarily an economic unit, and this also applies through the whole diversity of traditional families that have existed in the past. Traditional family was an economic unit in which having children was normally an advantage. This was nearly always true in agrarian production. To have a substantial family was an advantage because children would help out on the farm, and the family was an integrated economic unit in many cultures. Having a child was a benefit, and that's one of the reasons, of course, why bringing down the birth rate has been so difficult in quite a range of countries around the world. It only happens when the structure of the family actually changes and interests within the family change. But in Western countries now, the reverse is true. Having a child is no longer an economic benefit, and the family is no longer an economic unit. Of course, it is an economic cooperative unit, in the sense in which husband and wife contribute to an income, and not all wives work, not all husbands work these days. But it's not an integrated production unit in the way in which it used to be. People have separate jobs, of course, in contemporary societies. Moreover, having a child, everyone here in the right generation should note this, is now an extremely expensive business in Western countries. It's estimated it costs you about £100,000 if you're a middle class parent in the UK, paying for a child between age 1 and age 18. The real cost might be much greater because one of the parents, normally the woman still, might give up work or go to part-time work while the child is growing up. Having a child now is a different decision from what it was in the past. And I'd suggest to you, I think everybody sort of knows this, it's a resonant emotional decision to have a child. Some sense in which in many traditional cultures you didn't decide to have a child, you just had children. It was the normal fact of things, but for us it is, most people, a clear decision of some sort. And it's a strongly emotional one. And we live in the era of what some people call the prized child. Why do we regard child crimes against children as the worst kinds of crime? Well, partly because we esteem children much more in Western countries than was true in many traditional times, including the Middle Ages here. We have fewer children, but both the legal rights that children have, and I think the kind of ethos which surrounds the child as vulnerable person, is quite different from in the past. You might or might not know that about 50% of children at age 4 or 5 in the Middle Ages were simply sent off from their family to another family, often to work as a servant, and they quite often never saw their own parents again. As you also probably know, there's a big debate about how far people in the Middle Ages loved their children. The famous historian Arius is the main individual who proposed the idea that people didn't love their children in the Middle Ages in the same sense as they do now. That's much disputed by other historians since, however. But there's something about having fewer children, where having children is a cost, where it's an emotional thing or an economic thing, that simply changes the status of children in contemporary culture. Third, this is a crucial thing. In the traditional family, women, in almost all cultures, were the property of their husbands. That is to say, the traditional family was built around male power and patriarchal domination. In the UK and in most other European countries, women were legally the possessions of men in certain aspects of their lives and behaviour. And this only changed relatively recently in historical terms. The traditional family everywhere was based on imbalance of power between the sexes. And the traditional family everywhere was based upon imbalance of power between parents and children. You know the old adage, children should be seen and not heard. Well, in many cultures, this is how children were expected to behave. Children in our culture today have voice. They have voice legally. In some countries, a child can divorce its parents, for example. I think Denmark is one of those countries where you can legally divorce your parents once you reach age 15 or something like that. Certainly some countries where you can do. Children are expected to talk back. In contemporary societies, a lot of parents don't like it, but it is a feature of what family life has become, that children are no longer passive beings, and of course we don't expect parents to use physical violence towards them, although many still do. We don't expect parents to abuse them sexually, although many still do. I think myself it's very important to recognize how much the history of male power in the family was bound up with what some people call the dark side of the family, the dark side of the traditional family. Historians are uncovering more and more about how prevalent sexual abuse was in many parts of the world in the traditional family. And this sexual abuse normally involves males, the father or brothers of female children. You do have quite a few cases of female sexual abuse, however, mothers abusing children sexually as well as physically. And you know, what we've seen over the past few years is that this spreads into other institutions. That these remarkable things about, you know, Catholic seminaries, Catholic churches where children were routinely abused, orphanages where children were routinely abused. Of course, it's only ever affected a minority, and probably small minority, but the dark side of the family in this respect has only recently been uncovered by historians, and we're kind of struggling with this knowledge, I think. There's a strong tendency to deny that these things happened, or if it's accepted, to try to minimize them. But I think the striking thing is how much more common they were and they are than we used to believe inside what appears to be an Orthodox family. We mustn't go too far, because there's stress, so in a minority of cases everywhere, but nevertheless much more prevalent than most historians used to imagine, all bound up to some degree anyway with the patriarchal power of the traditional family. Also bound up with my fourth point, which I think is much more important than it appears on the surface, and this is to a certain extension of the third point, but separate one too. In traditional family and in traditional culture, you also have a certain version of sexuality which is strongly dominated by male sexuality. There is a kind of structural reason for the dominance of male sexuality. That structural reason was the need to ensure that mothers were the parents of their children for continuity of inheritance. And most traditional marriage in the family was structured around this explicit need. But what it rested on is a very important thing, I think, which is a dualistic view of women emotionally, held by men, but also held by women themselves. Taken over by women themselves as well. A division between the virtuous woman on the one hand, the virtuous woman being the married woman who behaves with sexual propriety, who is faithful to her husband. That's the definition of female virtue, I think, in most traditional cultures. Always separated morally and institutionally from the courtesan, the prostitute, the harlot, the whore. Adventurous sexuality was never permitted to the majority of women in any known society. The there have certainly been societies where you have adventurous female sexuality among minorities, for example, among courtly groups in Rome or in the Middle Ages, but it's always confined to a small minority. In the case of men, it's often been the majority. That is, it's often been the case that men, traditional cultures, have not only been expected to be, but encouraged to be sexually adventurous, sexually promiscuous, normally, of course, with the other category of women, the women defined as the other, that is, with courtesans, with prostitutes, with harlots. Women were not supposed to, of course, have experience of these things, but men traditionally did. And these things were positively valorized until very recently. Well, I mean, they still are valorized, I suppose, in many ways. The kind of thing I touched on briefly last time, male serial conquest sexuality, James Bond type, you know, sort of built into the culture, is characteristic of the norms defining sexuality. What it meant, I think, was that sexuality was largely defined through the needs of men, really, in most traditional cultures. And women's sexuality was structured around the emotional dominance of men, if you like. Sexual dominance of men, not just economic dominance of men in most traditional contexts, most traditional cultures, and still is the case today. Well, when you look at what's happening today, I think you have to say that on each of these dimensions, there is fundamental change occurring. Marriage is not only marriage and family, no longer just fixed roles, they're much more open, much more reflexive, I mentioned earlier. Family is no longer primarily an economic unit. We live in an age of sexual equality, where sexual equality is far from being a reality, but where women all over the world stake claim to autonomy and equality. And we live, I think, through a world of really profound emotional change, where disentangling emotional life from the characteristic dualism of women is such a difficult problem for many people in their personal lives. And as I say a bit later, is I think associated with violence, or certain kinds of sexual violence, which you see in many contemporary cultures. I feel there's a difference between the traditional violence of men against women, rape in war, for example. You know, rape in war is a continuous feature of history from ancient times to current events in Kosovo. But there's a different kind of violence, which is a sort of defensive reaction to the claims of women to equality, I think. Stalking through the world, and which is expressed in various kinds of fundamentalist religions that I mentioned last time, as well as in personal life and personal activities. If you look at this, you could list other changes, of course, affecting the family, but if you look at these four, you see how much has changed and is changing in the family. To me, it means there is no route back to the traditional family. The idea that you could return to the traditional family, simply restructure the traditional family, and somehow rescue people's emotional lives by doing that, seems to me a wholly non-starter. You couldn't do so, because traditional family was simply rooted in fundamentally different structures from those which you find in the contemporary world. And these structures are becoming globalized by the changes that we've discussed in previous lectures. Not only is there no route back to the traditional family, but in my view there shouldn't be a route back to it, because traditional family is based upon imbalance of power. Imbalance of power is not compatible with democracy. It's often based upon repression of homosexuality. Repression of homosexual rights is not compatible with democracy. It's often based upon repression of freedom of choice too. And that is not compatible with democracy either. So personally, I don't think either politically or sociologically you can see any route back to anything resembling what traditional family was. Of course, in Western countries, when people talk of the traditional family, they don't mean the traditional family at all. And it's perhaps important to point that out if it's not obvious. And many people, when they use the term traditional family, mean a transitory state of the 1950s, the kind of 1950s family, when women were still at home, when there was a certain amount of recognition of female rights, but when things were changing, there was just a transition really from one family form to another, a kind of idealized version of the 1950s family is what a lot of people have in mind by the traditional family, but that was never, it's in no way an expression of what traditional family was really like. Well, therefore, where do we go from here? Where is the family going sociologically, and what should be our political response to the changes we see? These are the changes I feel in the backdrop of the ones I've just described. They're more broad-ranging because they don't only just affect the family. First, in contemporary societies, and more across the world, the self, our own individuality, increasingly becomes a reflexive project. That is, our own self-identity participates in the reflexivity of late modernity as it becomes generalized across the world. In many traditional cultures, the idea of the self, continuity of the self, is carried by traditional structures. These structures limit you, but they also give you continuity and stability in your life. These things are not true for us, and I don't feel, and us in Western countries, I mean, and I don't feel these conditions will return. For us, therefore, we have this mixture of emancipation and anxiety that I mentioned last time. You can't have a self, I think, in contemporary societies, unless you actively work on it. You don't have a sense of continuity in your life unless you actually, to some part, construct it yourself. Construct it in the way you dress, the way you look, the way you envisage your career. The rise of the idea of career is really interesting because the notion of a career is a quite individualized thing. In traditional work, you didn't have a career. Actually, in blue-collar work, you didn't have a career. It's a kind of individualized expression of a more liberated form of workplace. When you have a career, you have an individual life, you have a biography. We have to kind of create our own biographies. That frees us from the past, and it particularly gives women a lot more freedom, I think, than they used to have. But it is a terrible burden too. With it, there comes the anxiety of empty identity. The key pathology of late modern culture is lack of a sense of identity, lack of a sense of soul, sense of an empty space where the self should be, and a feeling that one's life is lived as in a film. It's something which you don't really experience, something which you live but which is not authentic to you. Now, I think if you trace the early origins of psychoanalysis and therapy in Western culture, the reason why therapy is so popular in the West and why Freud came to the original idea of psychoanalysis was that Freud essentially discovered the reflexivity of the self. That is, Freud discovered that through, just like Marx tried to do in social life, through changing your own personal history, you can change your own individual future. You can hope to reconstruct your identity. All therapy, I think, depends upon that kind of reflexivity. It's a sort of it's a reflexive interrogation of one's past. And on the other side of it, there stands compulsion and addiction, as I analyzed it last time. Compulsion and addiction are frozen forms of autonomy. They're a failure of autonomy, where you can't get it together and you can't construct the kind of viable personal future which is open to you. That's why in Alcoholics Anonymous, the famous organization Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, you don't treat addiction as something physical. What you do is you rewrite your own storyline. You actually tell the story of your life before other people who also belong in the same community and have had similar experiences to yourself. Most so-called self-help groups or 12-step groups involve that kind of retelling of a life history. It is crucial to us. When you retell a life history in psychotherapy, you're only doing in a formal context what we do all the time. In our everyday lives, whether we know it or not, we continually tell and retell our life histories in order to make a life history at all. And it is, in lots of respects, I feel it is a more, it's a life that offers more happiness than in the past, actually, but it's one fraught also with anxiety and problems. Second, in contemporary society, the body also becomes a reflexive project more and more. And this is part of what I described in an earlier lecture as the end of nature. The end of nature outside of us is the end of a world where events simply happen naturally. The end of a world untouched by human technology. But what applies to the external world also applies to the inner world. We no longer simply have bodies in the way in which we did in the past. The body is not simply an accompaniment to life, the medium of life, in the way in which it used to be. Because the body is now almost wholly invaded by new technologies and reflexive forms of knowledge. These reflexive forms of knowledge include things like diet. Diet has become a central part of the experience of our lives in Western countries, I mentioned at the end of the last lecture. Especially affects women, because women have to make a way in a world where they're supposed to be freer than the past, but where the expression of the body, attractiveness of the body, is still residually very important in defining the female role. And women tend to experience the body with great difficulty in this kind of reflexive world. Anorexia and those kinds of eating compulsions are an expression of that difficulty. In surveys, there are only about 5% of women under 30 who say they've never been, quote, on a diet, unquote. Being on a diet is an attempt to construct a body in terms of what you eat or influence the form of the body. But the invasion of the body by knowledge, by science and technology, stretches all the way, of course, to the technological invasion in bioengineering, surgery, all sorts of minor things, contact lenses, glasses. We're all kind of extensions of medical technology in the way in which we are and the way in which we live. And what this means is that the very physical processes that you associate with the body no longer have the same inevitability as they used to do. Consider aging, for example. Aging used to be something that simply happened to you. You got old, you got ill. That's what aging was. Aging now for us is a much more reflexive sort of process. You have to decide how you should behave as an older person, what you can expect from your life. Lifestyle changes make an awful lot of difference to how healthy people are. The proportion of people who need regular institutional care under age 70 in Western countries, the age between 60 and 70, is no higher than age between 20 and 30. And all this is largely a result of lifestyle change, better nutrition. Aging is no longer something which you just experience. You're going to have to do it. You have to decide, as it were, how to behave as you get older. And of course, people are taking quite radical steps, really, in terms of reacting to that situation. Reflexive of the body is, you know, a fantastic theme. Wish I had more time to talk about it. But I mean, what could you see in 100 years? You could see this extraordinary possibility. You could see a rack of cloned bodies. And you could see a mind downloaded on a computer, and you could see that mind as interchangeable between those bodies. Some scientists have suggested this as a realistic possibility actually for much less than a century from now. Then you would have an immortal body and an immortal mind. What that would do to the life of human beings is being in a cycle of nature and death, you know, is anybody's guess. Third set of changes are the backdrop of the family is the emergence of, if you forgive me, I call plastic sexuality. Plastic sexuality is the liberation of sexuality from the male-dominated version that I mentioned before, a liberation which is far from complete. Plastic sexuality is sexuality that has no object until you give it an object. It has no form until you give it a form. With this sexuality, it has to be reflexively worked on. You might think, you know, sex is part of the body, like eating is, but of course eating always has a ritual form. You always have to organise it, you always have to do it a particular way, and that is true of sexuality. It may have a biologically given drive to it, but sexuality for us has become a much more open thing. So for example, you have far more people who move from being heterosexual to being gay, to being bisexual, back to being heterosexual again, and so forth. This will become more and more common, I think. All sexuality is a kind of exploration of what sexuality is. And given that sexuality is so difficult, so problematic, so important, but so threatening to everybody, you know, the source of people's pleasure, but the source of their greatest worry and oppression, and it's not surprising that obsessions and compulsions stalk the edge of liberated sexuality. All around the edge of kind of opened out sexuality is addiction, compulsion, and the possibility of violence, I think, as it were, around that. But I think, you know, as I've been trying to argue through this lecture, changing the emotional undertow of personal life are perhaps even more important than changes in the economic structure of, for example, the relationship between the sexes or the relationship between children and their parents. It's in the emotions that a lot of these changes are actually carried. You put these changes together with the ones I just described, what kind of family is emerging and what should be a politics of it? Well, I think what's emerging is something along the following lines. What's emerging is at least the possibility of what I like to describe as a democracy of the emotions. Democracy of the emotions is everyday life brought into line with wider democratic criteria. When I first started working on the family and personal life and so forth a few years ago, I picked up a book I probably mentioned to you before on public democracy by, I mentioned a book anyway, by David Held. It's called Models of Democracy. And I was looking at that book alongside reading literature on therapy and looking at what therapy said a good relationship is to that. And I was really struck by how similar the criteria are for things that seem completely separate at first sight. Public democracy, what makes democracy in the public realm, as Held describes it, or other authors describe it, and what makes a good relationship. Well, that's what led me to think that if you can create a world where good relationships become the norm rather than the exception, you're talking about a kind of democratization of everyday life and of intimacy. Because what's involved in democracy, what's involved in a good relationship, are roughly the following qualities. First of all, equality. I think in a good sexual or personal relationship, you assume the other person is equal to you. Many people have terrible problems with this. Women have problems with it just like men do. But I think you have to assume a norm of a good relationship, the value of a good relationship is equality with the other person. Second, it is the autonomy of the other person. In a good relationship, the person is not in a compulsive relationship with you, but a relationship of autonomy, where they have a certain amount of freedom and how they define their personal space within the relationship. Third, it's based on respect. You respect the needs, the interests of the other. Fourth, it's based on communication, it's fundamental to it. In a good relationship, you communicate with the other person. You can call this, in modern culture, the invention of intimacy, because the notion of intimacy was not known until relatively recently, but now the idea of intimacy is essentially what a good relationship is all about. What it means is self-disclosure. It means opening yourself out to the other person, something a lot of men particularly find it very hard to do in relationships with others, but it is a means of communication with the other person. Finally, a good relationship is one free from violence. Many relationships are not, unfortunately, free from violence, but a good relationship is. It is founded on communication. If you look at that list, and look at a longer list that I could draw if there was more time, each of these, I would say, are also components of public democracy, too. And I think you have a tendency towards the emergence of democratic possibilities in personal life in the three main spheres in which one could speak of personal relationships. First of all, in sexual relationships and in marriage. I'm talking here of values rather than reality, just as in public democracy, democratic behavior, as we see from some of the individuals I mentioned at the beginning, doesn't always live up to the values of democracy. This is obviously true of emotional life too, but as a value, I would say, this is something which we're tending towards in sexual relationships and we're sort of striving to produce. Second, it's also true in friendship, interestingly. History of friendship is really, really interesting, especially the difference between male and female friendships. Most female friendships are founded on intimacy. They're founded upon emotional communication where you tell the other person something. Most male friendships are founded on what you could call comradeship or buddyship. They're part of being, having a similar life experience. You went to the same school, along the same club, same interest in football. You communicate through a wider fabric, not through self-disclosure. So you find that many men have been friends all their lives. They don't even know what their friends do sexually, whereas you don't find many women think that friendships are with which this is not true. It's a struggle with intimacy, therefore it's a kind of frontline struggle with what friendship is. You can see that's becoming redefined among men, I think, in the contemporary period. And you can also see the resistances to it. The other area is parent-child relationships. I think what's happening is that these are also becoming more democratic. And as in public democracy, democracy is not inconsistent with the need for discipline and authority. A good parent is a person who gets his or her authority from his or her relationship to the child, not through violence, not through a traditional position, but through gaining the respect of his or her children. There's a kind of restructuring of authority relations within the family. All these add up to at least the possibility of family forms which are, I think, could recapture strong family life. You could say that out of these things, you could have strong family connections, and that these things would involve gays as well as heterosexuals, because a good relationship is the same anywhere. But there's an awful long way to go before they would really become generalized, and we don't know whether we can make this transition. I really think in Western countries we don't know whether we can make this transition. And at this point in conclusion, I return to the theme of violence, because there is a lot of sexual violence, especially from men towards women, physical violence. There's also, I think, a lot of symbolic violence from women towards men. If you look at studies of marriage and women's views of men, a lot of symbolic violence towards men. Not so much physical violence, probably, in most relationships, but an awful lot. Male violence, we don't know whether in the UK the rate of rape is actually increasing, or whether it's simply more people being prepared to declare that they've been raped. But there's at least some evidence that the rates of sexual violence are not going down, perhaps even tending to go up. Well, what could be happening is that the sexual violence now is different from the past, as I hinted at earlier. In the past, in the traditional dualistic model of women, there was an institutionalized system whereby men policed female sexuality. So that if you went out with someone, or you got a woman pregnant who you were not supposed to do, you would be sanctioned by the male relatives, in some cultures, killed or physically assaulted by the male relatives. There was a male policing of the schismatic position of women in traditional cultures. In a more open, democratic form of family life, of course, this is impossible, and this system disappears. But to some extent, I feel what happens is a counter-revolution, a kind of counter-revolution of men against the possibility of emotional democracy. And the new kinds of sexual violence are violence on the front line of that resistance, rather than being simply traditional forms of male sexual violence. But on that happy note, I hope that all of you have a really, really good Christmas and New Year, because I won't see you again. And I hope you all behave yourselves over the Christmas period. And I hope that, I sincerely hope that everyone is really enjoying themselves at the LSE, because I think it is a great intellectual culture, and I think it's great to have so many people turning up these lectures, so I look forward to seeing you in the new year. Thanks very much, everybody.